from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. David Brooks of the New York Times and the NewsHour joins us in studio in the hour ahead. We'll get his take on healthcare a year after and hear what he has to say about the recent events in Libya. We'll also focus our attention on his most recent book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. David Brooks is a regular contributing columnist to the New York Times, as well as a featured commentator on the PBS NewsHour, Meet the Press, and NPR's All Things Considered. An opinion shaper whom I once described as every liberal's favorite conservative, he defines himself as being a conservative with the New York Times as being a bit in position comparable to being the chief rabbi in Mecca. Much appreciated for his wit as well as his critical thinking skills, David Brooks is the author of Bobos in Paradise and more recently, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. He joins us in studio for the second hour forum, and good to see you again. Welcome.
Oh, yeah. Great to see you.
Let's begin, before we talk about your book, which I'm anxious to talk about with you, by talking about a couple of things that are very much in the news. You put on your commentator hat for a moment, because actually I saw you talking about Libya, and you were talking about it in conjunction with the fact that, it wasn't thought out, I think, was the way you put it.
Yeah, I in the past few weeks, as the controversy has broiled, I've sort of been of the mind that we really should do something. But as I've begun to see what we're doing, I grow more and more concerned about it, in part because even the decision-making process of the operation seems to have not been hammered out, and they're still fighting about that in Brussels, in part because I'm not sure what the Libyan opposition is like. And I have a friend who's there who has been meeting with those people, and the reports I get back from him are not altogether encouraging.
What is he saying?
He says some of them are impressive, but a lot of them are not. Some of them are delusional, and some of them are not the sort of people we want to be associated with. And so it's an extremely mixed bag. They're, of course, extremely disorganized because Libya is more or less a totalitarian place. I really don't see Gaddafi leaving. And I don't see us – we've sort of given him an incentive to kill everybody because we've said there's no exit for you. But we really haven't forced him out.
When we hit that compound, supposedly we weren't – aiming it at him, but he was probably being targeted, don't you think?
Maybe. I guess if you're going to really take sides in a civil war, take sides, but we're sort of doing it halfway. And it may do some good in the short term, but I've become extremely dubious about the thought process really surrounding it all.
Was it maybe too little too late? 22 days it took.
It took them a long time, but this is sort of the nature. I mean, I support the idea of having big multilateral action, but there are some disadvantages to it. They tend to be very slow. I was in Europe during the Bosnia situation. They tend to be very slow, and the decision-making process is so convoluted that it's very hard to organize people, and the French are already freelancing. The Turks in NATO are upset. And so it tends to be much messier and much slower and more cumbersome than other things, which is not to say we should do this unilaterally, but it's just been it hasn't inspired one with its effectiveness so far.
Are you sanguine about all that's going on in the Middle East, all these uprisings and all these changes of government, really, is what we're seeing? Somebody said it seems to be the monarchies and Gaddafi that stay in place and the elected presidents who step out of place. But, some people are really jubilant and think this is something to rejoice about, and some are very wary and apprehensive. How do you feel?
Right. And so I've spoken to a lot of people. I haven't been there since these uprisings have taken place, but I've noticed a dichotomy among the people who are back here analyzing it from afar. There's a lot of anxiety. Among the people I know who were there and who are there now, there's much more hope. And I think they derive that. They don't minimize the dangers, and they do say that being in some of these rallies is extremely scary. You're basically in a rally with hundreds of thousands of angry young men, and there's an undertone of menace. At the same time, they do say the commitment to openness and democracy and to really modernizing the Middle East is genuine and not going away. And so I think they tend to be more optimistic than the people who are here because they see an intellectual and emotional shift that's swept through the region. And so I guess I defer to them. I tend to be hopeful that whatever the political events of the day, underneath those, there has been an intellectual and emotional shift. People have a template in their minds of what a normal society is, what a society that affords dignity is, and they want that. And by hook or by crook, they're going to chase it.
As a self-proclaimed conservative who nevertheless has expressed a great deal of affection and respect for President Obama, how do you feel about what we were talking about earlier this morning? You didn't have an opportunity to hear it, but we were talking about health care 1 year after. Today marks the day that right. President Obama signed what has been called somewhat pejoratively Obamacare, but really was a health care reform of a major overhaul.
Right. And I, at the end of the day, didn't support it. I opposed it in part because I think we needed to achieve two things. One is to cover the 39 million people, which it does. But two, we really need to get a handle on health care costs. And to do that, I thought you really had to change the fundamental incentive structure in the system. And I don't think we did that. I think the Medicare actuary is right when he says that health care costs will increase. Inflation will increase under the bill, not decrease. And so I thought if you don't do one of the two major things, don't support it. I guess what strikes me is a year later is how a couple things. One, politically, the views have not changed. The polls I've saw, the aggregate of the polls that I've seen suggest people are roughly where they were a year ago. So there hasn't been much change. But I do think it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable most obviously because of the courts. I'm a little worried about the concentration of power. There's been a great wave of mergers, which the law encourages. And so in city after city I go to, healthcare has really come under the control of one company. And I'm a little nervous about that. And so I think there are good things that will come, but I'm a little nervous about the way things are going.
Talking with famed commentator and columnist David Brooks, who, of course, writes for the New York Times and can be seen on the PBS NewsHour as a commentator, and has a new book out, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. And sort of to begin talking about your book, I brought in a story that happens to be one of my favorite stories by Margaret Atwood, and I'm just going to read a paragraph here because I want you to read. You've never read the story. You don't know the story, right?
Yeah, I'm a blank slate.
Okay. Well, and reading your book, I thought of this, and it just she goes through different kinds of scenarios, and this is the first one. John and Mary fall in love and get married. They both have worthwhile and remunerative jobs, which they find stimulating and challenging. They buy a charming house. Real estate values go up. Eventually, when they can afford live-in help, they have two children to whom they are devoted. The children turn out well. John and Mary have a stimulating and challenging sex life and worthwhile friends. They go on fun vacations together. They retire. They both have hobbies, which they find stimulating and challenging. Eventually, they die. This is the end of the story. You get the sense of what I'm trying to bring out right. here, which is really goes to the heart of a lot of what you're writing about here, doesn't it?
Well, if the sense of what you're writing about is that people who have happy lives are boring, well, then I guess I dispute that. I think Tolstoy had that wrong, that all happy families are the same. And one of the things that bugs me and actually motivated me a bit to write the book is that if you judge by novels and if you judge by movies, you would think everybody in America, and particularly everybody in suburban America, was miserable. That maybe superficially they seemed cheerful, but deep down they were all deeply neurotic and crazy. And that's actually not true. Some people have led fulfilling lives. Their polls show that 90% of people are satisfied with their jobs, and maybe some of them are exaggerating, but a lot of people like their jobs. A lot of people like their family lives, like their towns.
But a lot of people feel if you have a, quote, happy and productive life, it might be a life without turbulence, it might be a life without conflict, a life without passion, which may be right. pretty difficult. I mean, that's why I think she's being satiric there and pretty right. much hitting the mark for what many people certainly
yeah, no, well, I would say that, but I think there's an element of snobbery in there. I think if you take a look at most people's lives, I don't think there are very many people who live lives without turbulence, without suffering. And to drive by somebody's house and look at the nice clean lawn and the pretty picket fence and to imagine that the life there is going beyond there is predictable and shallow is not an accurate way to judge people. That in most homes there's a great deal of turbulence and a great deal of suffering in the course of lives. And so even in this little story I tell, which is meant to illustrate psychological research and neuroscience research, the people in my book lead happy lives, but they commit adultery, they suffer business failures. We all do that, and that's even part of the happiest life involves a lot of suffering. And, you know, I say this just personally, just to be completely upfront here. I remember one of my mentors in life was William F. Buckley. And people used to say, look at that guy. He's rich. He's successful. Everything's going his way. How could he possibly empathize? And then he has a perfect life. And I think if you read his son's books about their family life, you can begin to see the reality of it. And if that's true of William F. Buckley's life, then that's probably true of everybody's life. And we should be appreciative of that.
This book actually got started because you wanted to find out, as I understand it, why kids dropped out of high school.
Yeah, that was really the entry of it. I care a lot about social mobility. And I was writing maybe 7 years ago about why kids drop out of high school. And a lot of, you know, the things we emphasize and things we're comfortable with are things like grades and SAT scores and IQ and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of the things that really shape who's going to drop out of high school are much deeper than that. And are often formed in the first few years of life. So can you relate to mom? Can you relate to dad? Do you have a model for establishing a relationship which you can then bring into the school and establish relationship with teachers? And so scientists can take a look at how kids attach to mom at 18 months of age and predict with 77% accuracy who's going to drop out of high school. They can take a look at kids at age 4 who has the ability to control their impulses. And they can predict who's going to complete college and what kind of income they're going to have, whether they're going to have problems with drug and alcohol addiction problems. And so this research took me to a realm of emotion, a realm of unconscious processes. And I found myself in the middle of this really tremendous advances in understanding our inner mind. And the book is really an attempt to take research from a range of maybe 10, 12 different fields, from neuroscience to psychology to behavioral economics, and really show how it applies to real life and put it into one story.
Well, you've read a lot of research here. I think you'd call yourself a traffic manager or something along those lines, because there is an extraordinary amount of as a reader of your columns, you know, I know you like these kind of social science research things. Why turn it into a novel? I mean, you know, there are some who have already come down on you and said, you're just using your characters as mouthpieces. You're not a fiction writer. I mean, in effect, they've been slamming you on that.
Yeah, a couple of people have. I mean, people either like that element or don't. But it's not a novel, and I don't claim it's a novel. It's an allegory. And the difference is when a novelist creates characters, they create them idiosyncratic, and they give them free rein to be sort of unique persons. The characters in my book are simply there to be not idiosyncratic, but to be quintessential. They're simply there to illustrate the scientific research.
Quintessential or archetypical, maybe?
Archetypical. Yeah. That might be a better word. Yeah. So, and I mean that in that everything they do in the book, there's some research behind them. And I created the characters in part because I have trouble thinking in abstractions, and a lot of the work that's being done in the lab is sort of a bit abstract. But I wanted to show how the things we're finding about ourselves play out in concrete situations. So I created the characters really to exemplify the research, not to lead the sort of independent life that fictional characters do.
Well, it was fascinating because I remember talking to you about the book, and you said, oh, I'm doing a book on neuroscience. And then suddenly I meet Harold and Erica, and it was kind of a pleasant surprise in certain ways. But I guess the sense of you're moving at least putative in some way out of what is normally considered your arena is what perhaps is causing some concern out there, minor concern, because many people find the book fascinating, as I did. Let's talk about, in fact, what's fascinating here. I mean, you get into this whole sense of what really is the unconscious, but not necessarily the unconscious the way people have come to see it in Freudian terms by any means.
Right. So we inherit this Freudian notion, which is the unconscious is this dark jungle of sexual repression and passions.
Bonic, yes.
Yeah. What essentially we have in our mind is we have two ways of processing the world. And we're aware of the conscious way, which is the voice in our head, which tends to be logical and linear. And that's one way of processing the world, but not the major way we process the world. So one statistic I cite in there, a scientist named Timothy Wilson, University of Virginia, says the human mind can take in about 12 million pieces of information, and it can be consciously aware of 40. And so most of the things we're taking in, we're not even aware they're taking in. Most of our decisions are influenced by biases we're not aware of. And, you know, my favorite illustration of this, one of the studies I came across from a guy at the University of Buffalo, said that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence become lawyers because unconsciously we bias toward the familiar, even a shallow thing as the first letter of a name or the way a name sounds. And so that's sort of the shallow
people think dentists become menaces, though.
Well, maybe they do that, but the first letter is important. My joke is I've named my daughter President of the United States Brooks for this reason. But also more profoundly, what are the models we have for relating to other people? Do we have the facility to look across a complicated landscape and perceive a gist, perceive a pattern in a landscape? My newspaper did a great story about soldiers in Iraq who could look over down a street in Baghdad, and some of them could tell tell whether there was an IED, a bomb, planted in that street. And if you ask them how you do that, how they knew, they would say, I don't really know, but I feel a coldness inside. And that's the sort of perception that leads to wisdom, whether it's perceiving a material world or social world.
Sounds a little like Gladwell's Blink in a way.
Well, but the difference is that Gladwell's Blink emphasizes first impressions. And one of the things we know about the unconscious is, like the conscious mind, effort and time really pay off. So you should go by your first impression if you've spent your lifetime analyzing a situation. But if you haven't, your first impression is likely to be wrong. So one of the experiments, they took chess grandmasters and chess novices, and they gave them 5 seconds to memorize a chessboard. And the grandmasters could replicate every single piece on the board. The novices could remember about 4 or 5 different pieces. And that's because the chess grandmasters did not see individual pieces. They saw formations. It's the difference between remembering a paragraph and remembering individual letters. And so experience and hard work, you train your unconscious to see better, to perceive better. You essentially educate your emotions.
And the conscious mind chooses what we buy, the unconscious what we like.
Right. So you don't have the choice to decide whether you like broccoli. You either do or you don't. Most of us really don't have a choice in who we love. The desire to love wells up from inside us.
Also those early maps, as you talk about them,
right.
that begin to determine, well, in fact, determinism comes into play here in a much stronger way than we like to admit. We like to think we have a greater sense of free will and volition.
Right. And some people in the field say we don't have any free will. The choices we think we made are just fantasies we make up to pretend that we're controlling our lives. I don't buy that. And many of the people I cite don't buy that. We have less free will than maybe we think because so many of these things are influencing us in different ways. But what our emotions do is they assign value to things. They tell us what we value. When we see someone behaving heroically, we feel a surge of admiration. Or if they're behaving unfairly, we see a surge of disgust. But just because we have these valuations, we still get to choose. And I do think the conscious mind, A, can educate the emotions by reading literature, music. You can make your intuition smarter. You can decide which environment you're going to be in. If you join the Marine Corps or you go to college, you'll be in an environment that will affect you in ways you'll never understand, but you do get to choose that environment. And then you get to choose among the signals that are welling up below to make a good choice or a bad choice.
In fact, you say at one point, I think this is a direct quote from your book, living is an inherently emotional business. And therefore, I guess work that people like Daniel Goleman have done become exceedingly important.
Yes. And
emotional intelligence.
Right. And that book came out roughly 15 years ago and is a very important book. And a lot of work has been done along those lines. I rely a lot on a scientist named Antonio Damasio, who's at USC.
He's been on this program.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a very elegant writer in person. And he points out that in 1995, if you went to the big neuroscience convention, there were no panels on emotion. And now emotion was one of the dominant subjects. So one of the really upsurges of this research is it gives us a different view of who we are. It sort of disproves the Cartesian notion that reason is the strongest of our faculties and that emotion is to be distrusted and that we progress to the extent that reason can dominate the passions. It really reinforces the Scottish view of people like David Hume, which say the sentiments are to be trusted and reason is often weak. And for me, and I live in the most emotionally avoidant city on earth, and so I live in a world where people are very unused to talking about emotion and in a policy world where people hate talking about that stuff and amputate human nature.
So how does this – I mean, actually, you can talk about this as being an essential irrationality to humankind that vests more in the emotion than it does in, say, what we think of as reason. But
right. But I would say it's not irrationality because that suggests it's dumb. But sometimes our emotions and the unconscious processes are much smarter than our conscious processes.
Our intuitive processes.
Yeah. Right,
well, how does this figure in public policy in your
– Yeah. Well, I mean, the stuff really – appeal to me, this whole body of research, because it solved some problems that I'd had. I'd covered so many policy areas where I'd watched failure, and so much of that failure derived from an insufficient or a shallow view of human nature. I covered the decline of Soviet Union, rise of Russia. We sent over economists, and were really blind to the lack of social trust in Russia, which caused everybody to steal everything. In Iraq, we sent over military people. We were, or at least the leaders, our leaders were oblivious to the cultural and psychological realities of Iraq. And we had a financial regulatory regime based on the supposition that bankers are rational, self-interested creatures who wouldn't do anything stupid en masse. That turned out not to be true when we had a sort of this emotional contagion sweep through the financial sector and cause everybody to misprice risk all at once. And then in education reform, we've had decades of education reforms that were bureaucratic in nature and skirted the core issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. So in all these cases, I think a shallow view of human nature has hurt policymaking. And I think it's hurt our culture. I think we're bad at talking about emotion, bad at talking about morality, good
and
at talking about material.
But talking about character, too. I mean, when reading your book, I kept thinking about a line out of Fitzgerald, character endures, that character is really what lasts.
Yeah, and well, you know, a lot of this came to me. You mentioned Fitzgerald. I did a story several years ago called The Organization Kid at Princeton. And I went around and asked the professors at Princeton, do you teach character to the kids? And they say, no, we hope they develop it, but we don't really teach it. We don't have a theory of character building. And I think that's indicative of a larger problem in the society, that we sort of know character matters, but we don't really know how it gets together, what it is, because we're inarticulate about these deepest parts of ourselves. Alistair MacIntyre, the famous philosopher, has this metaphor, which he says, we have words like honor and courage, virtue, vice, character, but we don't know how all these things fit together. Imagine having words like neutron and gravity, other scientific words, but having no theory of physics. That's sort of our
moral state. You want
a unified
field theory of behavior is what you want.
Well, I don't know if I want to. I don't believe in unified theories of anything, actually. But I do think
you should talk to Brian Greene.
Yeah, no, I should. I do think that this work reminds us of some old truths about how character gets formed. That, for example, that Nancy Reagan was wrong. We just don't have the power to just say no through conscious willpower to overrule ourselves. But we do have the power to build habits and to build ways of seeing the world and to build grooves in our minds. Change your behavior and you'll change your mind. Or as the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous put it, fake it till you make it. And I think that reminds us of a different view of human nature than maybe we go around with in our head.
Or maybe, as Kurt Vonnegut said, you are who you pretend to be.
Well, that's exactly right. If you, you know, there's a great, one of my philosophical lodestars is a guy named A.E. Dorfman, who wrote a great book called The Mental ABCs of Pitching. And he said, even if you don't think you're going to throw a good pitch, pretend you're going to throw a good pitch and eventually it'll come.
I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation with David Brooks, part narrative, part social commentary. The New York Times columnist's new book is called The Social Animal and explores the world of human motivations through his well, fictional characters, though it's not a novel, as he said, Harold and Erica. It seeks to illustrate the web of emotional and social influences which guide and govern our behavior and our relationships. And it has a lot to do with connectedness and human relationships, ultimately. You can join us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your call, so feel free to join us. 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. You're mentioning many of your mentors here and many of those who influence you. Rousseau is a big influence here.
Yeah, I mean, in a vague way. I mean, this idea of using characters to illustrate points, I say in the book I got from Rousseau's famous book, Emile. I should say, and it is a little more lowbrow, I didn't mention in the book, but I found a travelogue from the 1890s in my parents' house, and it was a travelogue of New York, and it was about a woman, and they did it not just as a straight travelogue, but as a woman walking around New York. And I loved that way of doing things.
You found that like right before the embarking on this book?
Yeah, and then just there's a one quick episode where she's walking down Columbus Avenue and somebody's drinking a beer and a cop comes up to the guy and says, if you want to drink a beer, go to Amsterdam Avenue, not Columbus, which is a perfect little detail.
When we return, more details from our guest David Brooks, your calls and emails and your web postings. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're speaking with New York Times columnist and PBS NewsHour commentator David Brooks. His latest book is The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Other books include Bobos in Paradise and On Paradise Drive. And he'll be speaking tonight in conversation with Michael Lewis as part of City Arts and Lectures at 8 p.m. at the Herbst Theater. And we'll go to your calls and your emails here shortly. You remember David Riesman's book goes way back, The Lonely Crowd, yes. Inner-directed people and outer-directed right. people. And a lot of this social research and cognitive science research suggests that we are really much more social animals than we think we are, even the most inner-directed people.
Right. And, well, two things on that. I'm a huge admirer of Riesman. But the first thing to be said is I became less convinced as I did the research as I saw it that we have permanent traits. I think we're really aroused by context, and we have many different personalities, and none of us is always inner-directed or always outer-directed.
We're protean selves?
Well, I think we have many different selves, and context really matters.
Now, so you don't believe in a unified Phil theory there either?
I do not, no, no. I guess I'm with Isaiah Berlin on all things, but on that particularly. But as far as inner-directed, you know, he didn't write this, but many people interpreted him to say that inner-directed was better than outer-directed, that outer-directed people were somehow conformist. But one of the things this current research, especially the field of happiness research, shows is that the relationship between money and success and happiness is very tenuous, but the relationship between with personal contacts and happiness is very strong. So joining a club that meets just once a month produces the same happiness gain as doubling your income. Getting married produces the same happiness gain as earning $100,000 a year more. The activity that most correlates with personal happiness, the daily activity, well, it's either sex or dining out with friends. The daily activity that detracts from happiness the most is commuting. It tends to be done alone.
You've read Robert Putnam's work,
yes.
Bowling Alone, and the
yes.
new one about religion and everything. I mean, community also is something that really fosters right. a sense of what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, and I would say among the ways this book has changed the way I see the world, it's given me a view of an entire different layer of action where the real action is, but it's made me much more communitarian. You know, I think in this country we've had two sort of individualistic revolutions, one in the 60s, which was about social liberation, one in the 80s about economic liberation. We've done pretty well by individual freedom, but we've probably neglected community and citizenship and bonds. And talking about relationships is really important.
Cultural Binary, It's a Wonderful Life and On the Road.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to that point, and I sort of have a section there, these two movies that sort of illustrate rival views of happiness. And the research suggests that It's a Wonderful Life is better, that you're going to be happier if you're ensconced in a neighborhood and a community than if you're out on, say, a motorcycle or a car just cruising down the highway all by yourself.
Let's cruise over to some of our callers and find out what they have to contribute to this conversation. Richard, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, my goodness. What a pleasure. First, I want to just say what a big fan I am, sir, of your work and of your commentary. And I'm more on the progressive and liberal side, but I find myself agreeing and just being appreciative of your thoughtful commentary so much of the time. I look forward, regardless, to reading your book. I did want to mention that earlier you folks were talking about Libya, and I think something that keeps getting dropped from the popular press reports of the timing of Obama's engagement and so on dismisses quite out of hand and too readily the idea that you know, we had to talk to Russia and China and get them to agree to not veto it before we had action. I just wanted to mention that and get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is the problem with policymaking, that you never have good choices and there are always incredible constraints. I asked one president, who will go nameless, what he learned in office. And one of them said, well, there's a lot of passive-aggressive in government that I wasn't appreciative of. You give an order and nobody does anything. But the other is just another person who was not president, but I asked, you know, what have you learned? And he said, I thought that if you were running an agency or a government and you had ideas about what the government should do or that agency should do, that you would be able to execute those ideas. And I now realize that's no longer true. Mm-hmm. There are just a million constraints. And some of the people who are organizing this policy, like Hillary Clinton or Samantha Power or the president, are faced with 1,000 constraints on what they can do. And I think you could make the case in their defense that maybe they have stopped a slaughter in Benghazi and other places. And beyond that, maybe they won't achieve much, but at least they've done that, at least temporarily. I still have my trepidations, but one always has to put oneself in their shoes and say, what are the real constraints they face?
Let me thank you for the call and go on to some more calls for our guest, David Brooks. Kip, you're on. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much, Mr. Brooks. I'm so excited to see the work you're doing on this. I actually did my dissertation on the role of familiarity in construction practices and how this kind of perceptual bias can get institutionalized. And so I'm wondering if you've read Seeing Like a State, and I can't honestly recall the author's name right now, but he talks about how large organizations and political groups and even whole states can operate under these perceptual biases to their great detriment, and how you potentially see this playing out, or what can we do to address this perceptual bias in policymaking?
Yeah, the book is, I'm forgetting his first name, his last name is Smith. He teaches at Yale. And that was a major book for me because he describes these two ways that a state can plan. And the one is the one that emphasizes the things that can be counted and modeled and quantified. And that, he said, led to a lot of development projects in the developing world which were not appropriate for local knowledge. And then he said there's another way of seeing, which he uses the Greek word metis, which is to immerse yourself in the concrete situation of a village or a town and to see the peculiarities and then to adapt what you see to that context, that landscape. And it's the difference between analyzing a project from afar using statistics and traveling like a wanderer through a place and sort of designing it for that specific place. Another book, by the way, a very short book, but a beautiful book I just read, is called The Wanderers, and it's about how people sailed hundreds of years ago from Indonesia to Hawaii without the benefit of compasses.
It's also a good novel by Richard Price and a film by Phil Kaufman.
There is. Well, it's a great title, so people use it.
You talk about talking about Greek words. Talk about thumos, can you? I mean, this is an important part of your whole gestalt.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of what we've done is, again, the research doesn't give us new philosophies, but it reminds us of some old observations about human nature. And I think we've lost a lot of concepts because we're so blind to what's going on deep down in ourselves. The Greeks were not blind to it. And they had a concept of thumos, or the thymotic urge. And they said, what do people really long for? Well, they long for money and things like that. But more than that, what they really long for is recognition, for an awareness of who they are, that people recognize who they are, and not only people around them, but at the highest level, the people hundreds of years hence or after we're dead will remember who we are and appreciate who we are. And that longing for glory is it can lead people astray, a Muammar Gaddafi, but it also, in the noblest sense, can really cause you to serve causes larger than yourself.
Talking again with New York Times columnist David Brooks, who is also a commentator on the PBS NewsHour. By the way, any thoughts about who might be replacing Frank Rich?
I do not. I don't have any inside dope on that. But the privilege to write longer than 800 words, as the rest of us do, is a privilege. So somebody should get it. And it's a great piece of real estate.
On we go. Brad, join us. You're on.
Thank you. I have so many questions, so I'll limit it to one, which is hard, which is a difficult task. I was curious, and not having read your book at this time, but listen to you speak on it, on your influence from Giambattista Vico from his New Science, because my development of that thesis and his philosophy is that mankind or an individual has major conflict in dealing with changes or situations that occur in their life is the attempt to impose logic on illogic or vice versa. In other words, each action and each deed that one performs has thought and emotion, and he translates the two. And when you try to impose the part of one into the other, into the realm of the other, is where conflict and instability stems from.
Well, I guess there are two things leap to mind there. One, Vico talked a lot about the incompatibility of different cultures and how we're immersed in cultures and how these shape our processes. One shallow little experiment I like to refer to is just on the importance of culture, and this is just indicative of something larger, is that somebody had the bright idea of measuring, of looking at couples as they had coffee with each other and measuring how often do they touch. And people in Rio, I think, touched each other just on the hand affectionately 190 times an hour. In Paris, I think it was 120 times an hour. In London, it was 0 times an hour. And so these are different cultural influences, and he really taught us to think in these terms. But the second point, and not quite on your
thought. Wait, so I had to say, who did the research where he had somebody walk up and offer sex with men and women, and 50% of the men said okay,
yeah,
and none of the women
right,
said yes?
A stranger would come up, and 75% of the men said yes. I forgot. It's been done many times. It was famous done a couple decades ago when it started, and 75% of the women, or 75% of the men said, yes, I'll have sex with you, 0% of the women.
And 75%? I thought it was 50%. That's even higher than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, they said yes. And though I've seen recent research just in the past week where they tried to figure out why. And if they found a man who the women were confident would be A, good in bed and who they seemed to like, then you did get some women saying yes. But you had to somehow reassure them that this guy would be good in
bed. But you also talk about how women are drawn to men with money and men are drawn to women with breasts. I mean,
yeah, well, these are genetic things. men like women with a 0.7 waist to hip ratio and always have in all cultures. Women like men who...
Even Russian?
Yeah, all of them. If you go back to the Raphael's paintings, they all have the same ratio, even if the thinness varies. Women like men who tend to be a little taller, unfortunately. One of the studies, a Dan Ariely study I cite, found that on an online dating site, a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers as a guy who's 6', so long as he makes $172,000 a year more.
Yeah, Dan Ariely is another guy we've had on a couple of times here. James C. Scott was the Yale author you were trying
That's
to
exactly figure? Right. Yeah. And I said Smith, but it's James C. Scott. Yes.
I want to go to more calls. Let me go to some of the emails here first, though. Here's David and says, I enjoy listening to David Brooks. He's interesting and insightful, but I don't think he can be said to represent Republican thought anymore. The Republican Party has moved too hard to the right while David Brooks has remained sensible. Most of the Republicans who think like Brooks have lost re-election. I don't hear many actual Republican lawmakers citing Brooks. While I still think he has something to say, perhaps it's time for him to pick a new label. Have you ever called yourself a Republican, actually?
No, I never have.
I didn't think so.
Conservative. I think that's somewhat true, though. When I speak to Republicans and I go to groups with Republican senators, a lot of them do read me. They may be to my right. I'm a Edmund Burke, Alexander Hamilton conservative, and I guess they would be more Milton Friedman, Thomas Jefferson, conservatives. So I think there's some truth that I don't represent standard Republicanism, but I think I do represent an ancient and important strain in conservatism.
Well, another political question from Keith. I really look forward to your analysis on the NewsHour every Friday at 3 and Mark Shields too, I guess. I hope you both continue. Will we ever see a true centrist political party in the United States? Is it feasible and how would it ever get started?
It would face challenges, but we do have a large number of independents who are disgusted with both parties, and we do have looming problems ranging from unsustainable debt to global warming that are not being solved by the two-party system. So I've always been a skeptic that we could have a third party, but I would say I'm less skeptical now than I have been most of my life.
Here's Shiloh, who says, Mr. Brooks, I've heard you say on previous occasions that you were politically to the left when younger but became more conservative over time. This was capped by a debate you had with Milton Friedman when he made an argument that you said you were unable to refute. As a Bay Area man in his early 30s, my husband and I have noticed a similar trend from the left to the center in ourselves as we get older. What do you think is responsible for this not uncommon ideological migration, and what was it that Milton Friedman said to you that had such an impact?
Yeah, I came out here to San Francisco and I did a TV show with him when I was about 22, and he, of course, crushed me in the debate, as you'd expect. But the more important thing was he took me out to dinner every night. We went to Girardelli Square, at various places. He took me out to dinner, and he sort of taught me what he thought. And to be fair, it didn't change me overnight, and I never really became a libertarian of his sort. But he opened my
Our former governor did, actually.
Yeah, that's true. And he had just met with Schwarzenegger that day. This was about 1984, so he knew Schwarzenegger back then. But it opened my mind up to the range of possibilities. And then a couple years later, I went back and I covered Chicago politics and saw some of the worst neighborhoods in Chicago, Cabrini Green, some of the projects there. And that sort of disillusioned me on some of the welfare policies that I'd been covered, and that moved me more to the right. But I would say in general, people move a lot of different ways, but I think people as they get older become more aware of their limitations on what they can know and can plan. And I think when you become aware of the complexity of the world and how little you can know, you become a little more skeptical of planning.
One of the things that gives you credibility, though, as you mentioned Chicago politics and moving more to the right, you've always been, I think, well, fan to some degree of Rahm Emanuel's, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Rahm's, and I'm a fan of the president's personally. I think they're both very thoughtful, and they conduct themselves in honorable ways. I may disagree with this or that policy, but I've never doubted their integrity or their really excellence as people.
Here's Michael, who writes, in the on-air discussion, you emphasize how important parents are to the development and level of success of the child. Do you think there is adequate public debate on this issue? To me, it seems like this is the 600-pound gorilla issue that politicians are afraid to mention publicly. For example, poor schools are blamed almost entirely on the teacher, not on the quality of the parents that send their kids to those schools. Should society expect more of parents, especially parents that have many kids they can't support, or is this too politically incorrect for open public discussion?
Yeah, I do think it is something we turn away from for an obvious reason, which is that a lot of the intimate connections are really important. And do we want the state interfering in family life? And that's a tough one. And I'm
it's kind of taboo as a caller.
Yeah, but right? I would say that a lot of the policies that yield the best results are things like nurse-family partnerships, where nurses come into the homes and coach moms, early childhood education, some of these things like the Harlem Children's Zone, which call themselves, they use the phrase parent neutral, but really they're replacing the culture of the parents with a different culture. And it's they're very paternalistic, but they work. And I think we should be wary of paternalism. But the results, I think, are strong enough that we should be experimenting with these things.
I think we're on point with this next caller, Yule. Join us. You're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Hi, Michael and David. Just wanted to mention, David, that I'm a recent convert, or I've been recently tuned in to your reporting and your writing, and thank you very much. I read Bobos recently, and I'm all of a sudden the hook's in my mouth, and I'm going to continue on. I wanted to just mention kind of synchronistically here that last night I read The Poverty Clinic in this week's, the March 21 issue of The New Yorker, and this morning I wasn't aware that you were going to be on, David, and I think some of the elements in your book overlap with the poverty, which is a local San Francisco clinic, by the way, just a few miles from the KQED office, and I just wanted to encourage conscious San Franciscans to read the Poverty Clinic and perhaps read your book as well. And I just wanted to ask, David, if you were aware of the Poverty Clinic and the research that's undergoing there.
I saw the article, but I've been traveling around, so I haven't read it. I think the article was by Paul Tuff, who wrote a great book. Was a former Times reporter who wrote a great book about the Harlem Children's Zone. And one of the reasons to be really optimistic about some anti-poverty work and some education work is we're finally beginning to talk about the importance of these individual relationships between teachers and students, within communities, boys and girls clubs, all these things, which that's really what matters. You can have a very bad upbringing up till 18 months, 4 years. But if you have a solid relationship at any point in life, it can dramatically change your life.
And I thank the caller. Another listener, Justin, writes, I read your columns with great enthusiasm each week, and I very much enjoyed Bobos in Paradise. Your writing serves a great and largely unfulfilled need in America, except, of course, for Mr. Krasny in the Bay Area, for the public intellectual, a generalist able to make sense of the increasingly specialized and compartmentalized scholarship in the humanities and social sciences. I'm wondering why you think there are so few truly public intellectuals writing for popular consumption in the United States, at least those who write as broadly as you do and who tackle the big questions. And I'm wondering if you think there is a reason that generalists are typically absent within U.S. intellectual circles. I'd like to know Mr. Krasny's thoughts as well. Well, let's hear from you first, David.
Okay. Well, my thoughts is there was a golden age of nonfiction. You mentioned David Reisman. I think he was in it. Jane Jacobs was in it. Daniel Bell was in it. And these were people who were sort of upper journalists or lower academics. And they were generalists, and they took over big subjects. Reinhold Niebuhr, from this period of 55 to 65, wrote a book called The Nature and Destiny of Man. I love the title because it covers a lot of ground.
One of our great Christian theologians.
Absolutely, yeah. And a hero of mine. But I think that that sort of broad, popular writer has been diminished partly by academia, which really encourages specialization, and partly because journalism has gone off, and maybe some of our magazines don't do this as well. So my column, frankly, is just taking the styles that Jane Jacobs and Daniel Bell and David Reisman pioneered and really replicating it in today's world.
I agree. I think specificity has a lot to do with it. I also think ideology has a lot to do with it. I mean, you think of public intellectuals, you think about somebody like Chomsky, who is really ideological more than necessarily wanting to cover the waterfront, as we used to say, or be the public. And plus, public intellectuals have much more of a kind of weight and maybe you can call it acceptance, cachet, all of the above in Europe than they do here.
Yeah,
that's been
true.
Traditionally true.
But, you know, I think there's a hunger for people who will take broad subjects. And that's really, for those of us in journalism or in the media, that's our comparative advantage. We can do things that especially a junior professor would never dare to do.
We'll take more of your calls. We'll go next to caller in Alameda. Kathy, that's you. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a middle school teacher in Alameda at a school that's extremely diverse. We have everybody. We have white, black, Latino, Filipino, the wealthy, the, you know, people on assistance. It's an incredible environment to be in. But one of the things I struggle with every day is this idea that you're talking about with character education and the relationships I have with my students. And one of the things as a middle school teacher I think is really important is developing those relationships, and especially for kids that have not been very successful in school. and promoting some of that stuff. But I don't, you know, I struggle with it every day. So I'd love to know what you have to say about the idea of character education and where to find out more information about it.
Yeah, I came across one researcher who said that if you want to know who's going to drop out of school, go into a school and ask the kid, who's your favorite teacher? And if they give you an answer to that question, that kid will not drop out. But if they look at you like the question is absurd because it wouldn't occur to them to have a favorite teacher, those kids are at risk. And I think I think in my own experience, I'm sure, Kathy, you've had the same. When I think back on my teachers, it's not really the curriculum that I remember. It's the way their way of being in the world that I could emulate. And there's a chapter in my book on just a teacher who emulates a way of thinking. And that's just being yourself is the best thing to do.
And thank you, Kathy, for your call. Here's Sarah, who writes a question for David Brooks about right-wing brainwashing. I've watched several of my cousins become angry and mean-spirited over the last 5 years. They spout right-wing talking points as if they were gospel. I'm convinced this is a Fox News phenomenon because Fox is their primary information source. Does your exploration of neuroscience provide an exploration of this frightening trend?
Not explicitly, though. I can tell you if you look at my email, I get a lot of angry left-wing spouting. But we are tribal. And there's a lot of, you know,
I get both, by the way.
good for you. I mentioned a lot of the positive sides of the unconscious, but there are some negative sides too. And we tend to be extremely tribal. We tend to like to cohere into groups, and we like perfect group loyalty. And that happens intellectually as much as any other way. And so I do think there are some people who want to be perfectly in tune 100% with their tribe and view deviation from the tribe as a source of cowardice or something else.
This is a broad question from Tom, but be curious to know what your response to it is. He says, can you please comment on the role of ideologues in today's society? I believe that a rigid ideology, whatever the bias, makes it difficult for society to reach effective solutions to our problems.
Yeah, well, this is maybe what we've been talking about, undertone of our conversation. I'm a big fan of Isaiah Berlin, and Isaiah Berlin really spent his life saying that reality is so complicated, there's no one system that can explain it all. The world is incommensurate, as he put it. There are certain truths that both things are true, but they conflict with one another. And so being aware of that—
Does that make you post-structural in your view of—
No, and he struggled with this. Does saying that make you a relativist?
Well, not even a relativist, but just, you know, you're talking about many selves, for example,
right.
And when you say there's no unified theory, and now you're talking about his view that things are so mutable and so changeable that it does suggest that maybe there's no solid ground here.
Yeah, I think you can have tendencies and solid ground without saying that there's one system of truth that explains everything, one logical truth that explains everything, and that we shouldn't try to reduce all of human history to a system, whether it's evolutionary system or Marxism or any other.
All right, I believe this is my friend Robert Redford on line one. Hi, Robert.
Hi, I'm going to be quick. This is a chance for me to. This is a compliment for David Brooks. David, I so long wanted to contact you, and I suddenly realized this is probably the best and only way I can do it. But I wanted to compliment you because I think, like a lot of people, so completely delirious with how sad it is that the two parties can't speak to each other. And I thought, what it so desperately needs an exchange of ideas that used to be like the old days. And I've read you consistently, and I've admired your willingness to have such an open mind. I thought, boy, do we miss that voice from the other side. How great it would be for our country to have an exchange of ideas rather than a shutoff on the one side. And I just wanted to take this moment to compliment you and say how grateful I was for that.
Well, I'm deeply gratified and honored that you would call in, and I can think of a million different ways you could contact me aside from this one. But I really thank you for saying that. And, you know, I think one of the things that if you write a column and if you do anything where you're going to fail a bunch of times, you become aware of your own limitations. And I think one of the basis of conversation across party line or across philosophical line is an awareness of one's own weakness and one's own stupidity some of the time, and that you need the conversation to correct for your own mistakes. You need the conversation to correct for the weaknesses in your own ideas. And part of the problem we have is that we have a culture of egotism in some place, especially in politics.
Certainly President Obama came in with that kind of spirit to a great degree,
right.
Didn't he? I mean, when he sat down with the police chief and with Henry Louis Gates, that was what that was all about.
I think so. But, you know, he's within a system. And one of the things I would fault the president, there's a guy named Paul Ryan, who's the budget chairman in the House from Wisconsin. And they'd love to, if they ever sat down and had lunch, they'd have a really good conversation. But Obama's never called them to have lunch, and they've never had a conversation.
I think that, just quickly, and I'll get off. I think that's really sad. And I think the open exchange of ideas and the ability to not appear shut off is so valuable to this country, and it did used to happen, and I've seen it go away over the years, and your voice has been such a almost like a voice in the wilderness for that exchange of ideas, and I just think it's great, and I wish there were more people like you.
Well, I'm deeply appreciative of that.
Thank you for the call, Robert.
Anyway, I'm getting off.
Did you want to say something, though, before you say goodbye about Elizabeth Taylor? We spoke about her. Did you work with her?
No, I didn't work with her, and I think the media will do its thing about her. I think she's had quite a life. That's about all I can say.
Well, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Good to hear from
you.
Bye-bye. Bye. I don't think we have time for another call, and we've got lots of emails. You do elicit a lot of response, and it's always a pleasure to have you here. And where do you go from here?
Well, I go from San Francisco, I go to Los Angeles, and then I hit the Midwest.
You started on a new project, have you?
I'm still too exhausted from this one.
Well, this is a prodigious project, and again, congratulations on it. And I want to remind listeners, although I believe it's probably sold out, but David Brooks will be in conversation this evening at City Arts and Lectures at 8 p.m. at the Herbst Theater. So good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to see you again.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page, or writing on our web page, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. And also, just a quick reminder that we have a feedback line as well, 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo, and to our engineer, Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.